This is continuing the interview with Bud Wilson on July 12, 1996 in Los Altos Hills, California. Okay, you were saying that Anderson went from Stibnight to
Boulder City.
Manganese?
Yeah, there was.
No, I think there was. Was that Bradley also?
No, that was not Bradley. But John joined us and as his manager, then we hired a man named Ian Ritchie, who was working in the uranium mines of and uranium plants of Rio Algon in Canada.
How'd you hear about him?
He applied for a job. Ian was a plant superintendent. Then they equipment operators and plant operators were mainly local folks.
Really?
Yeah.
You could get local people that were trained for.
Yeah, by local I mean in that part of the state. Now, mm-hmm. Not all of them came from Riverton,
no.
But there were. You know, there've been a lot of construction activity in that area, so there was this reasonable supply of experienced equipment operators.
Hmm.
That wasn't a problem.
What kind of equipment were you getting?
We used scrapers and front end loaders in mining operations.
Any particular brand? Or?
Well, that orange paint of Caterpillar was pretty predominant around that thing.
Mm-hmm. Were there, again, I would think there might have been some cooperation with your construction division.
There was, and we had a number of the folks out of the construction.
Mm-hmm.
Division came to work there. The construction organization built the facilities and did the initial stripping. So, and that initial stripping was done by scrapers. So by the time the mining operation took over, the mine organization was pretty well in place. One of the great things about working for a company like Utah, you always had available to you people experienced in dirt moving. Good one.
So, I guess maybe we're up to 1960 then. This airplane accident was a major shift, wasn't it?
Oh, it sure was. Major for me, Tony Macias was one of my closest friends, and it was a real shock.
You know, where were you when terrible. You heard about it?
I was in the San Francisco office.
Mm.
I think I said earlier that I was in Riverton, but that's not right, because I was in San Francisco office when the telephone call came in from Milford. And the word I had then from the pilots, see, the two pilots survived and two of the passengers, two were killed. The pilot called in from and I was asked to come down and tell Tony's wife, Betty. Did so, and then went over to tell Alice Wallace that her husband had been seriously injured. I didn't know how seriously, but I knew that he was in the hospital there.
Both families lived down here.
Yeah, Wallace's lived in Los Altos, over toward Mountain View. And Macias lived up in the hills. Well, that was tough from a personal point of view, and then from an organizational point of view, it was really difficult for the company.
Who was the other person who was killed?
Homer Mann.
Did they live here also?
Lived in Atherton.
But you didn't have to tell his wife?
No, Wes Barrighty, I think, went to talk to Helen. Helen was his wife. So that was kind of tough. But then, shortly after that, I guess sometime during, probably during 1960, Alan Christensen left the company. Ed Littlefield became president, general manager, and he consolidated the we moved from the Shell building to the building of 550 California Street, where we had enough room to bring everybody in, so that it was there in that office that the exploration and mining activities were consolidated with the rest of the company.
Construction.
Yeah.
Did they have engineering draftsmen and all that sort of thing as well?
We left the engineers down here. Our design facilities were in a building on the Stanford industrial grounds. They were not far from here. Mm-hmm.
They've stayed here, have they?
Yeah, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Dates are a little bit hazy.
Well, we can probably check them later.
And it was about that time that the company was reorganized and into divisions. So we had several years later, the mining division came into being.
By then, I would guess maybe this was just a de facto name change, had it, or was it a real
organizational
change?
It had its advantage in really delineating delineating responsibilities.
Well, their land development was getting very big about that time. And shipping
was Marcona.
Mm-hmm.
So when the company was reorganized into construction, mining, and land development.
Mm-hmm.
That must have taken place
'61. These are notes from annual reports. The '61 annual report says that there were three basic types of operation at that time: construction, land development, and mining, of which mining was the most profitable. And then in '62, the basic elements are now include ocean shipping and dredging, but the major source of profit was from mining.
You must have borrowed that ocean shipping from Marcona.
I guess so. Well, they were shipping from Australia also.
What year?
'62. Mount Gold.
Oh, Lake. Yeah, sure. We had to. That's right.
Then in I guess I can't tell from my notes when this reorganization took place. How did the change from Christensen to Littlefield relate to you, the change over from Christensen to Littlefield? How did this?
Well, of course it was. I'm sure it was a problem for Littlefield getting to know me. He had, of course, had known Tony and had put a lot of confidence in him. So it took us a while to become accustomed to each other, but I think it didn't take long for us to fall into place.
You moved your office up to San Francisco when? About that same time?
As soon as we moved from the Shell Building to 550 California, then we moved. Again, that's the early '60s.
Mm-hmm. Corner office?
I guess I was. No, I didn't have a corner office. Corner offices were occupied by senior vice presidents. My title then was manager of mining operations. Weston Beret was manager of geology and exploration.
Well, you became a vice president in '61. You were a vice president.
Yeah, well, that's when the move to San Francisco took place.
Christensen retired, Littlefield became president, and you became vice president. And Bouret, Crossley, and Vaughn. Oh, there were lots of vice presidents.
Yeah, in those days, vice presidents were a dime a dozen. That's it. Fallout from the construction division, having to have a vice president to sign documents. So we had vice presidents and senior vice presidents.
They really
weren't important until you became a senior vice president.
I see, okay. They expanded, I guess this must have been Littlefield's idea. The officers were expanded from 9 to 12.
I think that was his.
So these were the senior and non-senior vice presidents. So, Lucky Mac was still your major activity, was it?
It was. By that time we had begun to develop the Navajo mine.
No, this is at Four Corners.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Want to talk about that?
The Navajo mine? excuse me. This is a bituminous coal deposit on the Navajo Indian Reservation. The company had acquired a lease from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And
how did that come about?
I'm not quite sure. That lease acquisition was done by Homer Mann in Westbury when I was occupied with Lucky Mac. But a contract was entered into with Arizona Public Service Company to provide fuel to a Monmouth power plant that APS was to build.
What kind of power plant?
Monmouth, you know, the power plant was built at the mine.
That was a very long contract, as I recall, wasn't it?
Still operating under.
Yeah, 35-year contract. Is that unusually long?
Not for a Monmouth power plant situation, where the utility company builds power plant. It has to be assured that it has sufficient fuel to operate that power plant long enough to amortize it. But from Utah's point of view, yeah, that was a pretty long contract. We renegotiated the contract. Once while I was still working for the company, and I think it has been renegotiated a second time.
Why?
Decline in power usage and lower fuel consumption. At the time that contract was entered into, that was the lowest cost fuel period, the lowest cost fuel any power plant operating in the country. Subsequently then the coal deposits in Montana and North Dakota were developed, which proved to be lower cost. But the mine is still operating, power plant's operating.
Why were those others lower cost?
Well, the nature of the coal occurrence, thicker seams, more flatly lying, easier stripping.
Was the coal itself different?
I think it was. I think that's more of a subbituminous no, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Would labor costs enter into that as well?
I doubt it. No, I think the difference in cost is simply in the nature of the occurrence of the coal seam.
Okay. So, what did you have, how did this involve you?
Well, by this time I was manager of mining operations, so the operations at the Navajo mine were my responsibility.
You had people reporting to you from all the, directly to you from each operation?
Well, to begin with, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Al Geiger was manager of the Navajo mine. He had been manager of the Argonaut mine.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was operated by the construction folks.
Had Argonaut closed?
The Argonaut closed by that time.
Were you still involved with Argonaut when it closed?
Yes. Yeah, I was.
How do you decide when to close a mine?
When you run out of ore, or run out of contract, or both. Yeah.
Okay, we're...
Where are we?
I had asked you how you decide when to close a mine.
Well, I said when you run out of ore, run out of contract for the sale of the product, or both.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not that clear cut either.
The Argonaut mine, it was clear cut.
Was it?
We wound up the Argonaut mine under a contract for sale of the magnetite to
Mitsubishi?
No. Well, one of the Japanese steel mills. Nippon Steel.
Nippon.
It's interesting to note that the contract with Nippon Steel, the first contract Utah had for the sale of iron ore from Argonaut, was the first long-term contract entered into by the Japanese steel industry after World War II.
Mm.
And that was for 4 years.
4 years.
Yeah.
Oh.
first iron ore that was used by the Japanese steel industry after the war. Is that from Vancouver? Well, let's go on.
Okay, well, I was asking about the people that reported to you when you were manager of operations, mining operations, and you said Al Geiger from Navajo, and Anderson at...
John Anderson, Cedar City. At Lucky Mag.
And Cedar City?
And... that Ralph Long was operating Cedar City.
Now, did you still have the Arkansas?
Yeah, the Arkansas mine had shut down by this
okay.
time.
Okay. And Marcona was...
Marcona gone. Was not any of my concern. No,
you
Marcona
never...
was operated separately. And by this time, it's separated from Utah. To begin with, the manager of Marcona was Chuck Robinson. He reported to Alan Christensen about the time that Alan left. Then Marcona became a separate entity.
But still Utah participation.
Well, Utah participation in Marcona was at the board level,
mm-hmm.
not at the operating level.
Right.
And it was only some years later that I became a director of Marcona.
Mm-hmm. So in this period, it was not
That's right.
a part of your life.
Yeah, it very much was a part of
oh,
my
was
life
it?
Because we were competing at this, about this time, we were trying to sell iron ore from a planned operation in Nevada. And I was in Japan negotiating with Japanese steel mills when Marcona concluded that Utah's involvement in the Japanese iron ore business would be a conflict of interest. And,
uh-huh.
So there was an implied threat by Cyprus to sue Utah. And that, that thing fell apart.
How did you know about this?
Well, I knew about it because I was in Japan negotiating the contract. And I received a call from Al Reeves, who was the...
Al Reeves,
yeah. Who was the head of Utah's legal operations. Telling me to fold up my tent and come home. It was all over. Because I was very, very upset about that development. That iron ore deposit is still sitting over as a south of Reno and east of Carson City. I forgot what we called that thing. Because now it's a housing development. So it'll never be mine.
You never did develop it?
No, never did.
Did you do the housing? Did Utah do the housing development?
No. I think we relinquished the mining claims and subsequently somehow. Hello? Yeah. Huh? Yes?
Did you still have anything in the East, in the other parts of the United States? Is there any mining?
No, we didn't. And I hesitated a little bit because I think it was about this time that we had to shut down the Ozark Philpott mine.
Okay.
Again, for lack of economic coal.
Now you had two. You had Lucky Mac, and then you also, shortly after, at some point, you got the other.
Cedar City was operating. We were still producing iron ore for contract CF&I.
Mm-hmm.
We were shipping the Iron Springs ore to Kaiser Steel.
Was Ralph Long in charge of that?
Ralph Long was in charge of
mm-hmm. that. When did, now Australia was still exploration.
You know, I think that exploration office was established in 1960 in Melbourne.
Was this Bouret's idea?
That was, well, I think Christensen's
or
idea.
Christensen's.
We had been involved there for a long time with construction
mm-hmm.
in Australia.
Where was the construction?
Where was it?
Yeah. Was that in Queensland?
No, it was in New South Wales.
Right.
One of the larger projects that Utah did was the Eildon Weir, a large dam project, Earthfield mm-hmm. Dam. And then
Snowy Mountains.
Snowy Mountains.
Snowy Mountain Scheme, they call it, didn't
Snowy
they?
Mountain Scheme, yeah. Involved dams and hydroelectric plants.
Had you visited there or seen any of this?
Beg your pardon?
Had you visited there or been down to see any
of this? No, I made my first trip in 1960 to Australia.
Where did you go?
I went to Melbourne, and the man who headed that office was Dick Ellett.
Dick?
Ellett, E-double-L-E-T, okay. And, we were,
okay.
Ellett was exploring the Mount Goldsworthy. And it was shortly thereafter that we formed a joint venture with Cyprus and Consolidated Goldfields.
Where was Cyprus headquartered at that time?
Los Angeles.
And Consolidated Goldfields was in?
London.
London. How did this come about, I wonder?
First, because Utah and Cyprus were joint owners of Marconi. Secondly, because Goldfields was competing with Utah and Cyprus for the lease. You see, in Australia, the mineral is owned by the state. And in order to obtain rights to extract that mineral, you have to negotiate a lease with the state. So Utah and Cyprus found themselves competing with Goldfields And we decided, rather than to compete with each other, to join, and we did so, successful negotiating the lease.
But this had all been initiated before you came into the picture?
The expiration, the joint venture hadn't yet been formed,
no.
But the Utah was exploring Goldsworthy, I think, under a right to explore that the state granted.
Mm-hmm.
I recall we brought the joint venture together a year later.
In Melbourne? You did your negotiating?
No, we did that here in either San Francisco or Los Angeles, negotiating with between the three companies, Goldfields, Utah, and Cypress.
Now the Pima joint venture was later, was it?
No, that was earlier.
Okay, so you already had that with Cypress then?
Pima was operated by Cypress. Utah held 25% of Pima, Cypress 50%, and Union Oil Company 25%. But that occurred about the time I joined Utah. One of my first jobs was doing a economic analysis of Pima. Allowed Utah to make a decision to buy into the company.
I see. So you did have involvement with Pima then, you personally?
Tangentially.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't later than well, I suppose about that time that I became more active with Pima.
As manager of operations, did you have interest?
Well, she had nothing to do with operations.
No.
But I think there was a joint venture. There was a board. And as I recall, Littlefield and I were Utah board members. I think probably Tony Mejia had been a board member, and I took his place.
It was. Well, I don't think we want to get started on the Australian thing quite yet. We have more time to concentrate on that. Do you want to get that? Or? Okay, so. Getting kind of scattered here. Let's pull things together a bit. You didn't ever work then in the office in the Shell building. You didn't go up till they'd already moved to 550 California.
Right.
And you were given one of the offices.
Oh, wait a minute. That's not right. No, I did have an office in the Shell building.
Oh, did you?
So it must have been in '61 that we moved to Because I was in the Shell building when the mining department was established.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that was after Tony was killed. So I spent a few months in the Shell building.
I see.
Sorry, I'm getting
this
all disjointed.
No, that's all right. How did the architecture of the, what was the architecture of Shell building compared with 550 California?
Well, of course, in the latter we had more room. We had two floors of Shell building. Shell building is not a very large building.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think we took four floors in the 550 California building.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the office, not much. Offices are offices, not much different.
Well, I don't know. There can be a difference. Where did you eat lunch?
When I first, the first year I was in the Shell building, we had a coffee break. We were allowed 15 minutes coffee break. Everybody would leave the office and dash across the street to get a cup of coffee or do shopping or something, and the 15 minutes kind of became 30 minutes and then 45 minutes. And when we moved to the 550 California, we hired a catering outfit to bring a little coffee cart around.
Okay. It's a big change.
Yeah, it was a big change.
Productivity improved?
Productivity increased markedly.
Did you have your own secretary?
I shared a secretary. I guess in the Shell building there were three of us working on this mining department. Keith Wallace, who had just recently joined us then. Maybe Barney Greenlee had come on board at that point.
They had both been injured in the accident.
Well, but yeah. But Barney, I'm getting mixed up now. Barney was back to work. So was Keith. I think Keith probably became with us in 58, 56, God. I'll have to find out.
We can check those details, yeah. So.
Well, then we shared a secretary. It wasn't until I became quite busy that I could felt I could afford to have a secretary.
Mm-hmm.
guess just kind of generally we shared secretaries. We were an organization of engineers at that point. Engineers aren't prone to do an awful lot of writing and communicating.
That's right. Computers were coming in. Were you?
Not yet. Well, maybe just about that time, because we put our first computer in on a trial basis at the Lucky Mac operation.
Mm-hmm. What were you computerizing?
The accounts, the accounting.
Mm-hmm.
And,
there in Riverton or out
in Riverton.
In Riverton.
I can remember a meeting in which we went over with the Riverton staff the computer and all the things necessary to do to make it work properly. And the fellow who was our payroll, our paymaster, raised his hand and he said, "We can't do it." Why can't we do it? That is, we can't put this computer in operation. Said the forms don't fit my binder. That became a byword in the company then for years after.
Oh, was he serious?
Yeah, he was serious. He was a little guy who had been given a binder that says, "Well, this is the way you keep your payroll."
Oh my!
Yeah, if it didn't fit that binder, it's not going to work.
Were these punch cards? Or
big pardon?
Punch cards.
Yeah. The first computer application was punch card.
IBM, maybe.
I'm sure it would. Yeah. The first computer we put in San Francisco was an IBM 360.
When did you do that? Do you know, or whose idea it was?
No, I'm not sure when we did it.
You had your own computer. Though in the office, you were not farming it out somewhere?
No, yeah, we installed a computer in the office, which was a hell of a mistake. Cost an awful lot of money. Not only put it in, but where the cost was involved was paying to have the software produced.
Uh-huh.
I think most companies had an awful time with the initial computer installation.
I'm just looking at what you've got here now. You've got two printers?
I got two printers.
Copy machine printer, computer, fax.
You can't get along without them these days.
That's right, and not one of those things, even an electric pencil sharpener, not one of those things you could have had in those days.
No.
You've come a long way.
Sure not, I was still using a slide rule in those days.
Sure. Yeah. But you put a computer in at Riverton.
We put it in out there as we wanted to try it. No one could swear that it was going to work properly.
You got new binders?
Yeah. Put it in our tribe, become accustomed to the requirements of data processing, which I think was probably a proper thing to have done.
This was payroll first. Did you get into your
I went to payroll first and then accounts payable, and it progressed up the line.
What about your your mine?
Finally, we brought on the cost accounting, which out there proved to be very successful. It worked fine.
So your responsibilities then were changing. You started
changing pretty rapidly because the mining activities were growing pretty rapidly in the 60s. You know, just everything began to come to a head. Exploration projects paying off.
So your exploration was booming, and you're moving on from metallurgy up into administration.
Yeah, that's right. So we had, you know, at this point we're beginning to, we had Mount Goldsworthy, joint venture was coming into being. We had a very interesting copper exploration project going on in the northern tip of Vancouver Island near Port Hardy. Pretty exciting coal exploration results coming out of Queensland.
Mount Goldsworthy is in Western Australia.
Western Australia. And we were, by this time we were operating the Shirley Basin mine, the uranium mine. South of Casper.
Dredging. Who did the? You were dredging in Australia.
That was a construction division. Responsible for the dredging operations.
That's how you did that in early in Australia, didn't you?
You know, the first job for the dredges in Australia was dredging the channel for entry into Port Hedland, where the Goldsworthy Harbour was built. You want to reminisce a little bit on this thing?
Right. It's all about.
When I came back to Cal after the war, the dean of engineering was Don McLaughlin. That was in 47, 48. Then he retired, and Ray O'Brien became dean of engineering.
Merle
O'Brien, was that it? Something? Well, anyway. When I came back, I had to take a junior engineering exam. It was a 4-hour exam, mainly on mathematics and physics. I'd been out away for 5 years, you know, and boy, I was sure that I'd flunked that thing. And I kept waiting for a notice from the engineering office that I had failed the exam, and even when my name was called in the Greek theater to receive my diploma, I thought somebody's gonna jump up and say, wait a minute, he flunked that exam. And when O'Brien was a consultant on literal drift, that is the drift of solids along coastlines.
Mm-hmm.
So we retained, the joint venture retained O'Brien to consult with us on the Goldsworthy Port Hedland Channel, you know, what direction to build it and so forth. So I related this conversation to O'Brien at a joint venture meeting. He chuckled and he said, well, we didn't tell anybody, but we threw all the exams in the waste paper basket of those who'd been gone more than 2 years. I said, why didn't you tell us? So as far as the Utah activities here in the early 60s, things were really heating up.
Yeah.
You know, and probably the most exciting part of that is that coal developments in Queensland.
Yes.
We'll talk about that tonight.
Yeah, that we have to do in a section on that. So, a couple of things. You probably think I'm silly to keep asking this, but where did you eat lunch?
Where did I eat lunch?
Engineers Club? Maybe?
Well, it's in San Francisco. At the Engineers Club, I joined the what's the club on the Ferry Building?
World Trade Club.
World Trade Club. Yeah. Al Reeves was on director of the World Trade Club.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that'd be a pretty good place to eat, so I joined that club.
Was.
But one of my favorite places was Taddish's Bar and Grill.
Oh. The manager of Taddish's is an old high school friend of mine.
Is that right?
He was. He's retired now.
Yeah.
Chris Sendovich was the manager for years. He was from Leeds, South Dakota.
That's when I first started going to Taddish's here on Sacramento Street.
Great place to eat.
And they moved from Sacramento Street to Market Street. Mm-hmm. Left the old grill behind, you know, and then nothing tasted the same after that.
No. Great place. So that was where you liked to eat. Did you eat with the same people? Was there a group of people who ate lunch together?
Not really. No. Depended on who was in town and what we were doing. Another favorite lunch spot was the German gosh, I forgot. German restaurant down on, well, close to the waterfront.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's not worry about that.
No, okay. Well, I was just wondering whether you had a group that you customarily ate lunch with?
Probably. Mm-hmm. You know, not a group.
People that you worked with?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's ever any just one little select group that
you
know, worked around together.
Lunch with Littlefield, for instance?
Yeah. With the construction folks, quite often.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, they were doing a lot of work for us. The construction business, construction organization was doing work at Mount Goldsworthy. We were guess in the planning stage about to, at least the design stage for the Island Copper operation, Port Hardy.
What about bank relation? Were you dealing at all with bank?
Littlefield was handling the finance.
He did all the bank?
Yeah.
Or you had nothing to do with that? Yeah.
Only tangentially, you know. Mm-hmm. Wasn't until later that I began to.
Were you?
Well, as I began to get up in the organization, when I became chief operating officer of the company, we had a good fit, Littlefield and I, but he, the finance side of the business, and finance was terribly important to us,
mm-hmm.
and I on the operating side, that's where we worked. Well,
you were doing, at this point, when we're talking early 60s, were you doing budgets?
Doing my part of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Orville Dykstra was the chief finance officer. And
did these under, the people that were reporting to you, like Geiger and Anderson and Long, did they prepare their own budgets?
Yeah, well, yeah, they prepared their own budgets. Those were consolidated by the accountants for the mining operations, mm-hmm. and then consolidated into the corporate budget.
You had to defend the budget to somebody?
Oh,
did?
Yeah, you bet.
How does that go?
How'd it go? Must have gone all right, because I didn't get kicked out. I think by this time, a principal part of my job was to identify the best of the investment opportunities and to and to attempt to develop the confidence at the board level that would ultimately get us approval for project budget. My contact with the board was mainly at the executive committee level of the board with Littlefield and Brandon Eccles, L. Reeves, Orville Dykstra.
This is probably a good time to stop.
Uh-huh. Think it is.
Do you think so?
It's yeah. I've got to get to San Jose.
You
yeah.
have your job, and I don't, we've got to, I want to get started.